So this period, this time, is the time of Vaisak. It's kind of like the Buddhist Christmas and Easter rolled into one. And all the different temples and so on are doing their various kind of Vaisak activities. We were just last week at the Buddhist Council Expo in Cabramatta. This week it's in Marrickville, so if you get the chance to go along in Marrickville Town Hall this weekend. And Vaisak, of course, is the occasion that's celebrated as the birth, enlightenment and death of the Buddha. So traditional at this time to speak about the Buddha and speak about his life, so I'd like to do that for this evening. When we talk about the Buddha, of course there are the life of the Buddha is one of these things which is it's such a huge thing. The story is such a huge thing. It's the central narrative, the central story for the whole Buddhist culture for 2,500 years. And it's been told and retold so many times. It's kind of like, it would be like a game of Chinese whispers, except we can't say Chinese whispers anymore because it's racist. We used to call Chinese whispers. And every time it's told, it changes. Yeah, this is an important thing to know. Every time the story of the Buddha is told, like any story, it changes. But at essence, the life of the Buddha is very simple. Yeah? A man was born, called his name Siddhartha Gautama. In his adult life, he became disenchanted with his family life and career. He left home, became a wandering ascetic, and after 6 years of practice, realized enlightenment, spent the remaining 45 years of his life teaching, and then passed away at the age of 80. So that's the life of the Buddha in a nutshell. And of course, knowing the... And we don't know... You know, of course, much of what we hear about the life of the Buddha is the kind of the legends and the mythology. And one of the things which in modern times we like to do is to distinguish between what is quote unquote real history, the real facts, and what is the history. And we have this kind of idea that history or the facts is kind of something which is value neutral or objective, like we can actually say what the real facts were. The reality is that any version of events is going to be coloured by the perspective of the person who's telling them. I remember an anecdote about during the Second World War when there was a meeting between the three leaders, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, and Churchill said to the others, "Don't worry, history will vindicate our actions in this war." He said, "I know, because I'm going to write the history," which he did. So for me, it's a fascinating quest, a fascinating part of my own practice and study and trying to understand this thing called Buddhism is to try to find out who was this person, Siddhartha Gautama, and what was it, what was the strength or the power that he had that somehow made possible this extraordinary spiritual, cultural revolution which manifested in the what we know as the Buddhist religion. And I do think it's important to understand the difference between the history of the Buddha and the mythology, but I think it's also important not to dismiss the mythology, and this is what sometimes we tend to do, is to we think that we're very rational and very superior and that these things are just kind of childlike stories. But actually the mythology is also very important, and the mythology carries shades and depths of meaning which just a dry journalistic account doesn't. So it's important not to be dismissive of the mythology, but to appreciate it for what it is. The life of the Buddha, according to the traditional stories, began in Lumbini. Now this year is celebrated or remembered as the 2600th anniversary of Buddha. In fact, that date is just a conventional date. We don't really know what the dates of the Buddha were. The scholars make basically just educated guesses. The most recent scholarly, I think consensus is probably a two word, perhaps fad might be a better one, is to put the Buddha's dates, his birthday, at roughly 500 BC, and the date of his passing away, his parinibbana, roughly 420 BC. So this is kind of seems to be the, this is known in scholarly circles, this is called the median chronology, and that seems to be gained favour in recent years. So roughly 500 BC he was born, and around 420 BC he died. So they say he was born in Lumbini. His mother, Maya, had married one of the rulers of the Sakyan clan, Suddhodana. They were living in the city of Kapilavastu. When her time came, she returned to her family home in Devadaha. Maya returned to her family home in Devadaha. And this is quite a common feature of Indian storytelling, and obviously it was a cultural feature, and I still believe is a cultural feature in the Indian landscape, that the mother will return to her parents' home for the giving birth, which obviously must have been quite an uncomfortable thing. If the parents' home is quite a journey. I believe that's still done in Sri Lanka, is that right? Or until recently? Is that correct? Yeah? Probably these days not so much, but these days it wouldn't be such a problem. You jump in a car and drive around to mum's place. But in those days, you know, walking for several days through the forest and so on, obviously quite a difficult thing. And there's quite a lot of stories in the Buddhist Jatakas and so on of the different kind of adventures and misadventures and so on that can happen in those circumstances. So Maya, the Buddha's mother, left the father's home, going back to the mother's home, but she didn't make it. She gets halfway, and then she realizes. Actually, it's interesting, in the traditional story, it actually says that she went to the grove, the forest grove in Lumbini, to play. We were talking about this a bit earlier, yeah? The kind of play and so on. You can imagine this woman, 9 months pregnant, yeah, going to play in the forest. It's kind of curious, isn't it? Yeah, that's what it says. Quite in several different versions of it as well, actually. So But that was her time, so she gave birth in the grove in Lumbini. According to the traditional accounts, the devas came and celebrated, this massive light appeared and shone through the universe, and all of these kinds of miracles and so on occurred. How much of that is true, of course, we can't say, but the actual, the basic motif of Maya giving birth in the forest on the way back to her maternal home is quite a realistic one. And the what we do know about the birthplace in Lumbini is that of all the Buddhist sites, it's marked very, very clearly. There's an Ashokan pillar. So the pillar was probably put in place about 150, 200 years after the Buddha's life. And it says very clearly that Ihe Buddhe Jate, which means here the Buddha was born. Yeah? It's a signpost. And it has a kind of this inscription where it says, because the Lumbini was the town where the Buddha was born, they're going to reduce the taxes of the local village. Yeah. So these are the benefits of that, and so that Ashokan pillar still exists, yeah, and still is a very clear marker of that site. So it seems very likely that that's actually where Lumbini was. It's in Nepal, just over the border from India, just slightly north of the border from India. The Nepalese government claims to have located, in fact, the exact spot on which the Buddha was born. I'm not quite sure how well founded that is, but the recent excavations is what they say. But certainly we know where the site is. These days it's a very nice park. Yeah, there's some ruins around, some beautiful Bodhi trees, and they've managed the site quite well, so that they've kept the temples and things, they've sort of moved them away a little bit so that, you know, reasonably quiet and so on. You can go there and do some meditation, some chanting, and just spend some time in the quiet. So if you ever get the chance. So the Buddha was born in Lumbini. They brought him back to Kapalawattu. His mother, Maya, died after 7 days. Yeah? And again, this is to me, a very realistic detail. In the mythology, because of course, as we know, up until recently, and in fact even today in many parts of the world, it was quite common for mothers to die in childbirth, yeah? And this was a very normal thing. So that particular detail strikes me again as being one of these very realistic details. I have this kind of suspicion that you will kind of wonder how that affected Siddhartha. I mean, I'm not by no means an expert on infant development or something, but surely the death of one's mother at 7 days must leave some kind of unconscious imprint or effect on the child. And when he came to his maturity and gave his spiritual realization was based on, sorry.
I was wondering, has the number 7 anything to do with anything? As we know, the number
sure.
7 is can be described as a special number.
It is, yeah. That's very true, and in these stories around the Buddha's life, and in Buddhist myth generally, you find the number 7 repeated again and again and again. Yeah, so it's definitely used in a symbolic sense. So whether that means that you know she died after exactly 7 days or not, it's hard to say. But she certainly died shortly afterwards. But generally speaking, the number 7 has a meaning of the cycle, the whole cycle of life and death. It's based on the astronomical cycles, yeah, and the turning of the years, the turning of the weeks, and so on. And so it has this kind of meaning of the whole cycle of birth and death, like in the 7 days of Genesis, the whole cycle of creation and so on. And it's repeated countless times. The Buddha's, you know, the Buddha was supposed to take 7 steps after he was born, and after the Buddha's enlightenment, he sat meditation for 7 days, and we find this number repeated again and again. So, yeah. So I kind of wonder whether the Buddha's teaching, which is based on this idea of suffering, of loss, of separation, yeah, the suffering of death, the separation from the beloved, yeah, I wonder whether deep in his the very formative, very tender age that he was there, whether this kind of departure of his mother, who he would just have been coming to know and just coming to have some sense of, and whether that in some way influenced his spiritual growth as a mature man. Be that as it may, he was then brought up in his home in Kapalavastu. The details from the early scriptures are very sparse about that. It mentions that he had quite a, what was by the standards of the day, quite a luxurious upbringing. He's obviously in the kind of one of the upper classes. And you know, he had kind of silken clothes, and he had good quality rice with the dark grains picked out, and the 3 palaces for the winter, the summer, and the rain season. But having said which, you know, by modern standards, you know, it's not. Oh, it's nothing special by modern standards, is it really? I mean, these days, you know, we all have palaces, 3 palaces for the summer, winter, and in the summer you just turn the aircon on, in the winter you turn the heating on, basically.
I think there's a pretty big difference between the aircon and having 3 palaces. We're talking completely different locations and very picturesque.
Maybe.
Have you been to China? The Winter Palace and the Summer Palace.
Yeah, but they're the palaces of the emperor. The Sakyan Republic, where the Buddha grew up, was a republic, wasn't an empire. It's a fairly small region, certainly compared to China, and it was run by a governing council of the leading clans. Rather than by a kind of one overriding emperor like China was. So the Buddha's family would have been like a well-off family, not so much like a king really, but more like the lords of the manor, like you might think in medieval Europe and England and so on. So you have like a manor home and the grounds and servants and things like that. You probably have title over some villages or something like that. But then the lords of the manor of that region would sort of get together to sort of govern the region as a whole, rather than what we tend to imagine as a sort of a great king. You know? So it's a little bit more humble than that. Anyway, so he was, but he was certainly brought up in that relatively luxurious setting, given a good education and so on. Of course, brought up, raised by his stepmother Mahapajapati, who was Maya's sister. Many of the details of his many of the other details of his family life are a bit obscure, but he did get married, it seems. Interestingly enough, the name of his wife is given almost in a different form in virtually every time the story is told. I compiled a partial list of them. I've got about, there's a Yashodhara, Yashovati, Bimba, Bimba Sundari, and about a dozen names, yeah, in the different sources for the Buddha's wife. In the early sources, interestingly enough, it just calls her Rahula Mata, the mother of Rahula, yeah, which is a common way of addressing that a mother. So Rahula being the Buddha's son. So she doesn't. She's a very kind of mysterious figure, really. Yeah, from the early scriptures, you really know very little about her. So the Buddha living in the palace, probably like as a very talented and intelligent young man, probably being kind of groomed for a role as a leader and so on in the clan, a lot of expectations on him. And then he decided he wanted to go forth, he decided to leave the home. So this is obviously a very kind of wrenching decision for him, and the descriptions talk about him going out in the legends and seeing the four signs. Yeah, he saw the sign of the old man, the sick man, the dead man, and then the sign of the monk. And each time he saw that sign, he went back to his palace and he brooded. And as you get this kind of the way it's kind of talked about, it's almost like he was in a kind of a depression, you know, like a spiritual depression of this kind of this sense of angst and kind of worry, of like a feeling of being trapped, a feeling of meaninglessness, a feeling that, well, he's in his life, he has all of these things which are in the kind of in a worldly sense, you know, they are he's successful and all of those things, but somehow it wasn't enough. Somehow it didn't really satisfy him. So again, it's difficult from the very sparse details that you have to sort of know too much about what happened. Most of the stories that it tells you about what happened there do come from the later legends. For example, the story of the four signs, yeah, is incorporated at a later date. The things, what the Buddha himself said about his own enlightenment and his own that own time was fairly limited. Sorry, not about his enlightenment, about his period in the palace and so on. It was very limited. He didn't talk about himself very much. So we're left to speculate, really, about, you know, things like, well, what happened with the missus, you know? Yeah? And there's, if you read all of this, quite fascinating, actually, if you read the stories of this, and, you know, many stories written in ancient times telling this leaving home. And each one addresses it in a slightly different way. Yeah? So you have this kind of basic problem, which is that the Buddha was supposed to be completely compassionate and loving to everybody, but then he goes and abandons his wife, right, and child, yeah, which is not normally the behaviour that we expect from even a person of reasonable loving kindness, not to speak of tremendous loving kindness, yeah. So this is a kind of interesting juncture, and it's a juncture which, from what I've heard, has been kind of exploited in recent years by certain less than completely ethical Christian missionaries in places like Sri Lanka, where they will speak to their children and say, you know, do you love your daddy? They say, yes. Do you like it when your daddy comes home at night? Yes. It's so nice, you know, does he bring you nice presents? Yes, he does. Oh, what happens when your daddy goes away? Oh, I feel so lonely. Yeah? What would it be like if your daddy went away forever? Oh no, that would be so terrible. Yeah, but isn't that what the Buddha did? He went away and left his family. It's not very nice, is it? Yeah. So this is some of the recruitment techniques that are used. But you have to admit there's a kind of point to it, isn't there? Yeah? It's not very nice to go away and leave your family. Yeah? And so we can see when we approach these things, we can try to explain it away. Right? So this is kind of rationalizing tendency, which would say, well, actually, you know, they had an extended family and the Buddha knew that his wife would be looked after and the son would be brought up and so on and so forth, and which is all perfectly true. Yeah? But it kind of misses the point, actually, right? I mean, to her, it wouldn't have mattered very much. She wouldn't have been like, oh yes, my husband's walked out on me today, oh but never mind, I'm going to get something to eat anyway, so really it doesn't matter too much. Yeah, that's not how she's feeling. Yeah, one of the stories when it has the Buddha leave and Yashodhara says, take me with you, take me to that place that you're going. The Buddha says, I will. Or the Buddha Siddhartha, it's Siddhartha then, says, I will. Yeah? Which he did, of course. Yeah? Yeah? The place he went to was Nibbana. And eventually his wife also went forth and became fully enlightened. Another version of that story found in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya develops it in a lot of detail, where Yashodhara, the wife who's staying at home, sort of copies all of she's getting regular reports about what Siddhartha's doing in his spiritual practice when he goes forth and he stays with the different teachers and does different practices and so on, and messengers are coming and telling her what he's doing. And she basically does the same practices while staying at home. Yeah? So he's off in the forest doing all of these meditations and so on, and she sort of figures out what he's doing and does the same practices the whole time. Yeah, this is another version. One of the version that we're most familiar with, that Rahula, the Buddha's son, was born shortly before he left home. And on that very night, and he looks in and sees the mother and child. It's very kind of poignant. It's like a soap opera or something. Kind of looks in and there's the mother and child. There's another version where he wasn't born on that night, but he actually was. She remained pregnant for the whole 6 years while the Buddha was practicing. Yeah. And only when he became enlightened, she became enlightened and gave birth on the same night, so everyone was happy. So what's interesting about these different tellings is that each one, the fact that there are so many versions which are so different, tells us that the traditions, they kind of worry at that little point. Yeah, they weren't kind of quite happy with it. Yeah, there's always this need to think about it, to reflect on it, to come to some way of seeing it or understanding it. And I think it's very important to accept that and not to try to explain it away. Because to me, what happens at these points in stories, and especially in great myths, like the story of the Buddha is a great myth, is that There always comes a time when the hero of the story has to face a choice. Yeah? And that choice is like an agonizing choice, where he has to choose between doing what's right in a conventional worldly sense and what's right and what's something that's going to some kind of higher sense. And that choice is always tragic. It always involves a sacrifice. And if we try to explain it away and say, well, it wasn't really a sacrifice, then in a sense you're taking out the tragedy and the power of the story. Yeah? Actually, the very power of the story is not that, you know, Yashodhara was well supported by lovely friends and so on. The power of it is the very grief of it, the trauma, the very strength of the love that they had, and the difficulty and the pain of that choice. So he left, rightly or wrongly, and I think it's quite legitimate to say that, you know, I mean, he wasn't a Buddha then, yeah. So we're not sort of doctrinally required to say that he made all the right choices. Maybe it was the wrong choice. Interesting, in some of the past lives, the situation was reversed. So there's one of the Jataka stories where the Buddha was living with Yashodhara, yeah, in the past life, and they had three children, and they both wanted to go forth. Yeah? And they were talking, and they said, and the Bodhisattva in his past life, he says, actually, darling, I'd really like to go and become a monk. And she says, well, look, I'd really like to become a nun. And they say, well, it's not going to quite work out. We've got to look after the kids. And she says, well, we better think about it. She goes out to, says, oh, darling, I'll go and get some water out of the well. Doesn't come back. He's like, where's the missus gone? She's gone off to become a nun. She's quite happy. And so he sort of keeps looking after the kids until they're old enough to look after themselves. And then he goes forth and becomes a monk. Later on, they meet each other. He says, you walked out on me. She said, what are you? You're supposed to look after the kids. What are you doing here? So anyway, maybe this was a karmic thing, I don't know. Yeah, but it is interesting to notice that you know, that is kind of, again, it's addressed, you know, the story of the Buddha's renunciation. It's not just the story of the Buddha's renunciation. Actually, if you look in the Buddhist stories, the Jataka stories, it's told again and again and again and again. The Buddha goes forth in countless lives, and each time this is handled slightly differently. Sometimes they go forth together. So sometimes the husband and wife both go forth and live in a forest and do their meditation and stuff quite happily. And so it can work many, many different ways. Every time it's slightly different. Anyway, so Siddhartha goes forth, leaves everything behind, chops off his beautiful hair, shaves off his beard, takes off his silken robes and puts on the rough cloth of a hunter. Yeah, so this is, you know, he's dressing down, like, seriously. And this is not just simple stuff that he's wearing, but actually he's wearing the clothes of the outcast. You know, these robes were the clothes of hunters, condemned criminals, the executioners, exiles, and so on. Yeah. So to wear these robes and the shaven head was a sign of being like one of the kind of the lowest or the least in the world. Sacrificial victims would wear these. So took the clothes from the hunter, and he went off to practice with various spiritual teachers, both the teachers in the Brahmanical Vedic tradition and also in the kind of the radical ascetic traditions which were popular in India at the time. Tried everything, and according to the traditional accounts, he kind of excelled at everything that he did, but it was not enough for him. It wasn't sufficient. And he did the ascetic practices until he was virtually dead. And again, these details sound quite extreme, but they're probably quite realistic. I mean, the reality is that there's thousands of ascetics in India today who are doing these kinds of things. There's no reason why the Buddha didn't do them. Eventually, he rejected all of that and looking for another way. So, one of the impressions that I get from reading the stories of the Buddha is just this sense of this kind of relentless determination that he had, this incredible commitment to this ideal which he was intent on. You know, even though he had everything, he was just prepared to leave everything behind. And even in the spiritual life, you know how easy it is to settle for easy solutions, you know? He wasn't as if he was kind of, he couldn't meditate or anything like that. I mean, he obviously was very skilled at meditation. And so many people, you know, end up, you know, you find something that's suitable or something that's easy and you sort of go along and do that. And he just would not be satisfied. He would keep on questioning, keep on inquiring. Anything which didn't answer the basic need that he was looking for. And what he was really looking for was for an escape from birth, aging and death. Yeah? An escape from birth, aging and death. Now, he wasn't satisfied with anything less. It's So he rejected all of those things, and then he reflected on what could be this thing, which is the path to enlightenment. Yeah, remember how incredible this is when there's no examples, there's no one to show the way. Yeah, I mean, for us, we think spiritual practice is hard. Yeah, because we're lazy and full of defilements, basically. We know what we should be doing. Yeah, but we just don't do it most of the time. Whereas for the Bodhisattva, for Siddhartha, he really didn't know what actually is it. What am I supposed to be doing? And he kept on trying these different ways and these different paths, really trying it, not just messing around, but really, really giving himself to it until he was virtually died. And it still wasn't enough. What is that way? What is the path? And so it's at that moment, this was, he was at that time was staying near in the kingdom of Magadha, near a place which today is called Bodh Gaya, and he was staying, according to tradition, over the river, and there's a cave not far from Bodh Gaya, which was supposed to be where he was staying when he had this realization. And he reflected on an experience that he had as a child when he was a young child. We're not quite sure how old he was, but his father was away working, and he sat under the cool shade of a rose apple tree. And as he sat there under the cool shade, his mind went very peaceful. He started spontaneously started just watching his breath, and his mind went into samadhi, went into the first jhana. And when he recollected this event so many years later, it just occurred to him, could that be the path to enlightenment? And then somehow came this intuitive awareness, this intuitive understanding, yes, this indeed is the path to enlightenment. Eso va mago bodhaya. So there's obviously something very, very special. This is the crucial juncture that marked the turning point in his spiritual quest. Something about that experience, the peacefulness of it, and I think also the naturalness of it, that he just sitting peacefully, the mind just following its nature, just allowing it to become peaceful. And it wasn't to do with any doctrine or dogma. It wasn't like part of a system or a method or anything like that. It was just an intuitive following the ways of the mind. And to me, this is also something which is very, strikes me as being a very realistic episode. Even though we might think that it's, unusual or impossible for people to get into these deep states of samadhi. We often can go away and go on retreat for, long periods of time and just sit there and think about things for days on end. And we think, how is it possible for a child to just go into samadhi? But it happens. And I'm sure it happens more often than we think. And I've spoken to several people who've had these kinds of experiences where they will just spontaneously go into a state of deep meditation without any training or any idea how to meditate or anything like that. Perhaps after all the methods are just getting in the way, I don't know. And I'm sure this kind of thing happens. And so he recollected that. So something about that. And the other thing which really is a very realistic part of this realization is that if you've ever had a kind of a deep meditation experience or some kind of other sort of deep spiritual realization, it's something which leaves a strong imprint and trace on the mind, which the mind will come back to. It will actually re-emerge. It's like a wisdom which is there and actually will come out when the time is ready. And you think, ah, yeah? It's that kind of eureka moment, yeah? Just realizing. And so somehow, even though he didn't have any proof at that stage, right? It was just an idea. Oh, maybe that's the path to enlightenment. Yeah? So he thought, okay, let's go and I'll do that. So he went. He thought he had to eat. At that time, he'd been fasting a lot, so he was very weak. So he thought, I'll have to eat something. So he took some rice and bread. In the later versions, of course, elaborates that with the story of him receiving the donation from Sujata. It's no relative. And Sujata is actually a very common name. And she offered the rice to him. And still near Bodh Gaya, just over the river there, there's a village and a shrine and so on for Sujata. So he then saw the beautiful, thought, where can I go to meditate? And he saw the beautiful grounds at Bodh Gaya, the sort of gently sloping ground, the tree, the Bodhi tree, which probably was kept clean and maintained by the local villagers as a shrine. Yeah, it's very common in India that any of the great trees in the area would be kind of worshipped as a spirit shrine. So they would keep that area clear, and then villagers would come and make offerings and so on. So he kind of saw that, got a nice mat of grass to sit on, and came to sit meditation. Now, in the kind of direct accounts of the Buddha's enlightenment, it seems that he kind of realized, oh yes, this practice of jhana that I did as a child is the way to enlightenment. And then he went to Bodh Gaya and just sat and became enlightened that very night. But there's also that's just a kind of impression. It doesn't actually say that. But there's also quite a few other suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya especially, which give a very, very clearly show that the Buddha spent, you know, a long time actually developing his meditation and so on. It wasn't that necessarily happened. It wasn't just like, you know, he finished his ascetic practices and then got enlightened straight away. I think there was actually, after he stopped doing the ascetic practices, when he actually was starting to develop meditation, I think that took a considerable time. It's not clear at all how long, but at least a reasonable period of time. In any case, so the night of his awakening came, the full moon night in May, month of Vaisak. He sat under the Bodhi tree, sat meditation all night and got enlightened. So if you want to know what that's like, you come to Santi Monastery for the next Jhanathon. I'll have an all-night meditation. And you too can get enlightened. Or at least sit up all night. Or at least try to sit up all night. Or at least watching other people try to sit up all night. And I think that there's something, you know, again, I think this is both a realistic detail. It's actually quite normal for meditators to meditate and practice all night. There's something about meditating at night where the energies are more subtle. There's just something about it compared to the day. And you find it very normally when people are doing kind of long retreats and so on, that people will tend to prefer to stay up much or most of the night. And there's something about this idea of bringing awareness into the darkness, yeah? He's, you know, that the night, of course, is always a synonym for the unknown. The analogy with the unknown or the unconscious. And so he was like shining a light into all of that, you know, maintaining awareness. Now, the actual process of what happened during that night is expressed in quite a few different ways. So there are many suttas that look at that from different perspectives. But the most common way of describing it is in terms of the threefold knowledge, what they call the pevijja. So I'll just briefly explain what the pevijja are, because this is the content of the Buddha's enlightenment. The first of the three knowledges is the recollection of past lives. So after the Buddha developed, or then the Bodhisatta, developed his deep samadhi until his mind was very clear, very pure, very steady, and then he inclined his mind to recollecting his past lives. Now, if any of you have been on a meditation retreat, even actually happens in just an ordinary meditation, but especially, but almost, I think almost always you'll notice it on a meditation retreat, is that your memory becomes more clear and more purified, and that when you first come to on the retreat and you're meditating, almost always you'll notice that the things that you think about and remember are the things that have just happened, yeah, just before you came to sit, or maybe the things from the day before. And after you've been meditating for a few days, the mind tends to go back further and further in time. Yeah? Memories spontaneously arise, which you hadn't thought about for such a long time. And sometimes they can come up very clearly. Yeah? Something from childhood or whatever. And the longer you go in meditation, the deeper your mind goes. Now, I'm not talking about practicing this. I'm just saying spontaneously it's what tends to happen. And the mind will access deeper and deeper memories. So I think this memory of past lives is like a purified and perfected form of that. Even that gulf of rebirth, that period of time spent in the womb and spent as a young infant, where the mind is and the brain is being reprogrammed and learning and how to adapt and learn in a new life, and that kind of during that process, it seems we usually forget most of what's happened in past lives. But at this point, he can see through, if I broke through that curtain or that veil that separates us from our past lives. And so he could recognize them and recollect them. And the text is very clear with all of these kinds of different kinds of knowledges that it's that his knowledge was very precise and very clear and very definite. Okay, so this is not like a vague impression. Oh, I've been here before, yeah, or a kind of a memory which maybe, you know, seems like something that might have happened in my past life. Yeah, it's a power and it's a skill where he could go to whichever life he wanted to and recollect all of the details of the name, his family, what he did, what he ate, all of these things in detail in however many lives he wanted to. So this was the knowledge which he developed in the first part of the night, in the first of the three Mithyavijja. And so, of course, in doing this, this is not something which is arbitrary. This is something which is fundamentally linked with the initial purpose of his quest. His quest was called the Arya Pariyasana. The spiritual quest was to overcome these limits of birth, aging and death. Everything he saw in his life came within this kind of cycle of birth, aging and death. It was going on all the time, again and again and again. And by recollecting in his past lives, you know, he could see this pattern being repeated over and over and over. Yeah? And he could see being reborn in different places, different kinds of lives, different realms. But always these cycles of birth, aging and death just happening again and again and again and again and again. And no matter where you're born, no matter what your life consists of. So this was the first knowledge. The second knowledge that he had was what's called the Dibbachakku, which literally means clairvoyance. Dibba, often translated as divine, but the root meaning of Dibba actually is clear. Yeah, so Dibba is also the word means the sky. Literally, it's the same root as in English the word for day. Yeah? The divine or the day. It's whatever is clear. So Dibbachakku, the divine eye or the power of clairvoyance, clear seeing. And what this power refers to is the ability to see the passing away and reappearance of beings according to their karma. So previously he was recollecting his own lives. Now he's able to see not just his lives, but also others. And he's able to see when people die, yeah, according to their karma, they go on and they get reborn in different realms. People with good karma getting born in good places, people in bad karma getting born in bad places. And again, he could practice this and see this very, very clearly. And so this is again kind of extending and expanding this appreciation or this not appreciation, but this understanding of the nature of samsara, the nature of these cycles of birth, aging, and death, which he was longing for escape from, longing for freedom from, but still couldn't understand how to get out of this cycle. What is there that transcends this? So finally, in the last watch of the night, he develops the insight and understanding into the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the way of practice leading to the ending of suffering. So in these Four Noble Truths, again, is not arbitrary, but is closely linked to everything that had gone on beforehand. He was seeing that the origin of all of this, of all of these cycles of birth, aging, and death, the origin of all of this is attachment, craving, yeah? Greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah? The kind of the afflictive or defiled or ignorant forces in the human mind which keep on going to get more. Yeah, this is the cause of suffering. So suffering is not caused by somebody else. Suffering is not caused by the will of a creator, deity. It's not caused just by chance. It's not something which is predestined. It's not all of these things were false. Suffering was something which arose from our own choices, from our own attachments, our own desires, our own ignorance. And so because of that, because it's something that's inside us, it's also something we can let go of. So he learned how to let go of that, which is what he called nibbana, is the letting go of suffering. And of course the way of practice leading to that was what's called the Eightfold Path, which I don't have time to talk about in detail. So the Eightfold Path, in a sense, was the answer to the quest which the Buddha had right from the beginning, which was how do you get beyond this cycle of birth, aging, and death? So, according to the traditions, at the time of dawn, the Buddha was sitting. As the sun came up, he finally was able to let go of all ignorance, all delusion. And from that point on, he was called the Buddha, the awakened one. So time's getting on a little bit. I don't have time for the rest of the Buddha's life here. So that's probably enough for this evening. And I'd like to invite if anyone has any comments or questions about the Buddha's life so far.
Let's finish up by paying respects.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadem Svakhato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Namasam Svatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sangham